It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
We're doing a series of reflections about big stories, struggles, things that have happened over the past year in 2018. And obviously one of those that sticks out is the Abolish ICE movement. And we're joined here today where we're lucky enough to talk to a group of people that represent four different cities because there was just so much going on. And if you remember, if you listen to This Is America, the podcast, when it first started out, it was a lot of it was talking to people on the ground, different encampments. But just to get us started off, let's just talk about how did Abolish ICE start in your city? How did people come together and what was the process like of kind of moving from this thing kicking off into people actually deciding to do something on the ground?
Well, I'm from Portland, so since ours was first, we had a rally the night before it basically started. That was to protest family separations and bring some more awareness to the situation. We, in our city, we'd been doing, like, various groups had been doing a lot of activism centered around that ICE building for a number of years. So I think it had a lot of focus. And then some folks from the vigil the night before just decided to stay. And it built from there.
In Tacoma, we have the Northwest Detention Center, which has been being protested for quite a few years by the Northwest Detention Center resistance. And once things started rolling in Portland, we had somebody show up and just start occupying, and it snowballed from there. We had a lot of people that were there, and then after we had arrests happen on the 27th of July, more and more people came up. So that's kind of how it started here.
In San Francisco, sort of the similar thing to Portland, it sounds like, is how we held a rally there to, like, protest the Immigration and Customs Enforcement's, like, family separation policies, and just general immigration, like anti-immigration sentiment. And then intentionally, some people had brought in a bunch of tents and stuff to set up in the like garage driveway for the building to camp in the street that night. Sort of used the rally as cover.
And in Chicago, we ICE does a lot of work here, so we wanted to do stuff about it for a while, and we saw the occupations popping up in other places, so we tried to do that, and we got booted by the police fairly quickly, and so we just started doing a lot of actions, and it grew pretty quick, just doing action after action after action.
Well, let's kind of switch gears now and talk about the encampments themselves. And I know Chicago, you're in a kind of a different situation because you know, you all kind of went off in a different vein, and obviously there's a lot going on in Chicago from, you know, people protesting different sites and different campaigns going on. So, you know, feel free to respond however you feel. But just in terms of the actual encampments, I'm just curious if people can talk about those. And, you know, what was the struggle like to basically, you know, get that off the ground, like achieve the numbers that it did, but also just, you know, maintain the camp itself? I mean, like looking at the photos in Portland, for instance, you know, probably some of the most iconic ones, just people, so many people out there. And obviously in Tacoma, people have been doing that for so long. People have been going out to that detention facility, you know, week after week. I'm just curious, you know, what was it like to maintain those encampments, and what were some of the issues that came up within that?
Well, in Portland, and I think we have a lot of connections to Tacoma. There are a lot of groups that have been doing work in the Northwest area on this for a number of years. So I think, again, a lot of back work sort of led up to this. But also we found because after the first week, people were still coming in for checkups, check-ins with ICE. We worked pretty quickly to try to establish legibility for those folks. So we got translators down as soon as we could. We got materials written up in different languages so that we could communicate with people about what was going on, because we recognized that it was pretty intimidating to, you know, down there and not only see all these people, but also all of this federal presence. So that was definitely one of our first struggles. It felt like it grew pretty naturally. Like the first night there were 10, and then the next night there were 15, and then built from there. There was certainly spreading the word, but I think that a lot of people were just really ready to move on that subject.
That's sort of how it felt in San Francisco too, is that it's not really sort of like, we did do a lot of outreach, and like we planned party on the 4th of July and stuff like that to try and get support and people to show up. But really people just kind of started showing up. I mean, the first night we had maybe like 10, 15 people, say. And then from there it kind of just grew on its own, like with houseless folks in the city and the neighborhood coming to take refuge in this place that was sort of safe. You know, people that are passionate about it, like there's a lot of a pretty big immigration population in San Francisco, so, or immigrant population in San Francisco. So, you know, a lot of people are really supportive of this cause, just kind of showed up.
Yeah, we had a bit of an interesting situation in Tacoma because the Northwest Detention Center is not within the city. It's in the tidal flats. And so there's not actually a lot of like people that go down there. So we had one person kind of start showing up and more people came and it grew. And then, you know, the cop came through on the 26th of July and arrested 9 people, which like boomed us for a second, but then we started to struggle. So there was like a period of time for like a week and a half where it was like a rotating group of maybe like 10 people. But like we kept an encampment up the entire time. And actually then we had like a large group of people from Portland come up and join us for a while. And that really helped us to continue to maintain our presence because like a lot of people were really burnt out trying to rotate through 24-hour.
Well, and we all had been doing it for months before that too. So years.
Right. The Northwest Detention Center Resistance, which like I support, but I'm not like a direct part of that. You know, they've been going down there for years and doing vigils and protests and, you know, overnight stays occasionally. And like, that's a pretty large group. And like, we were working with them for a period of time. And then there were some issues that popped up, but like our occupation was a little shaky for a while because nobody wants to go down into a Superfund site. So it was an interesting scenario.
To the person in Tacoma, to you specifically, I'm just curious, like, was there tensions that developed? Because obviously like this abolish ICE thing just kind of exploded. It's all over the news. People are going out to these different places. But obviously in Tacoma, there was, as you said, there's people have been doing this for years and years and years. How did that play out? Like, you know, you have like a, you know, people on the ground that have like been really dedicated to supporting hunger strikes and all the organizing that's been happening, you know, inside the facility and outside. And then all of a sudden this huge thing blows up and then people kind of like from outside that community are like rushing to this thing to get involved? Like, how did that all kind of like come together? Was there tensions, or people were able to work it out, or how did it happen?
Like, there was different phases when this started. There was a lot of conversations that were happening with NWCDR and also the Puyallup tribe, because the prison is on stolen land. And so, there's a lot of like trying to work together and respect each other and make sure that like everyone's needs were being met and everyone's voice was being heard. And then we started to have some issues with, you know, like there's a lot of people that really wanted to make sure that Abolish ICE was an autonomous action. And like some people were really invested in trying to maintain this relationship with, you know, an immigrant led like group that's been doing this for a long time. And then there were some people who were really struggling with that and trying to figure out how to do it. And so like some interesting tensions developed, and like we continued to support each other as much as possible. But it definitely was strenuous, especially because, you know, there were people that support NWCDR that don't really appreciate tactics like yelling at guards or like, you know, being disruptive in that way and like trying to support them while also doing what we thought was right. It was difficult, and I think that we managed it as well as we could, but like there was definitely some lessons learned.
To the people in Portland, you all were one of the larger encampments. What was it like having that many people there? Was there like tensions at times between different groups or cliques of people, and like visions of how things should be, and how did people work that out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was interesting because like clearly with that many people, there's a lot of revolutionary potential, and it was to see different people and groups come in, and to a certain extent there was room for projects, you know what I mean? Like people could pick up work that they thought needed to be done and kind of autonomously handle it. We certainly ran into the same sort of conversations about appropriate types of protest. Of course, like large movements like the you know, migrant rights movement is going to, you're going to have to be able to talk to a large cross section of people. And that's, I mean, that's one of the reasons we worked on having interpreters, was because we recognized that for a lot of people, it was going to be a, kind of a scary situation, and not just because of the police, but because of, you know, protesters. And the thing is, with that many people, you quickly realize that no one is going to be able to control everybody. You're not going to get everybody on the same page, you know? So it was really important to us to make sure that those folks that still did have to interact with the state in that space felt safe. And we did a lot of work on that. We also, one of the things that I like to brag about was one of the best things I saw develop at our camp was an ASL interpretation group. Started with, because where the ICE building is located in Portland is really close to not only high-end, high-rise apartment building, but when the area stopped being developed, the city put in a bunch of assisted and low-income buildings. So we had a fairly large deaf population native to the neighborhood that was coming down and trying to figure out what was going on. So we had a couple of volunteer ASL interpreters, American Sign Language interpreters, that came down and basically formed their own AG, and started scheduling themselves and coming to make sure that there were interpreters. And they have actually maintained that and, are now providing, interpretation for the activist community in Portland at large, which I think is amazing. They're called Fingers Crossed Interpretation. I'm totally going to plug them. Anybody in Portland, hit them up. Free interpretation for your events. But yeah, so I think there were amazing projects that came out of it like that. But of course, there's going to be, you know, material difference in the way we want to approach the problem. And I think like that's definitely one of the lessons to be learned from this. But I think that as much as we could, we tried to keep access for as many elements as possible, you know?
Yeah, and now to the person in San Francisco, you know, one of the things I think that was really impressive about the encampment there was just how built up it was. You know, it was very, you know, there's like fences. And
yeah.
You know, it was very, very fortified, I guess would be a word.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, can you talk about just, you know, not saying that you were involved at all in any sort of illegal activity, of course, but I mean, and just in your perspective, watching things unfold, you know, what was that process like?
It was pretty cool. I, you know, like it was like I went to work one of the days and came back and there was a new barricade up, sort of stuff like that. Lots of cool art, you know. It moved pretty fast. It was just a really cool thing to see all this fortification and stuff. It was less of a functional thing and more of a, what's the word? Like symbolic gesture, big, like an attempt to tell everyone that we weren't going to be moved, which, I mean, obviously didn't end up being the case, but I still feel like the largest, like the largeness of like, and the strength of the fortifications that we built and like the walls and stuff and, really sent a message. But it was a cool thing to see and we had the, you know, the big barricades obviously that were pretty, pretty obvious. And then we've got like pretty well stocked and set up medic tent. You know, we had like, Narcan and first aid supplies and like menstrual products and childcare products, stuff like that. And then we had the kitchen, which was always stocked with hella food, like giving it out to anyone who asked for it. Like little arts tents and stuff like that for kids to be playing in and taken care of and stuff. And people like teaching kids how to do balloon animals and stuff like that. And, it was a really cool thing to see. I don't know what else to say about it besides that.
You know, you attempted an occupation. It didn't work out. What was it like kind of moving from that phase of not being able to launch an encampment to then like basically developing a strategy outside of that, but still being involved in this wider current?
For us, it was like after we couldn't get in the encampment, we decided that we should go with a direct action strategy. And we decided to target ICE and Customs and Border Patrol's corporate partners. So we started against Accenture, who has a $297 million contract to recruit Customs and Border Patrol agents. And we started with like teach-ins and information campaigns. And we actually got them to, we did a lot of that and those were really beneficial. And then they started circulating a petition inside of their workforce. The workers started it to drop the contract with CBP. And we did a lot against them. And we've also done a lot against Heartland Alliance, which is, one of the bigger names here in Chicago. They hold all the child detention facilities in the area, and they also do a lot of other work. Like they have a lot of medical facilities and housing facilities for people. So they usually have a pretty positive name, but in reality, what they're doing is helping jail children. So we went against them as well. And we've been seriously hurting their recruitment drive.
Yeah, to expand on that, we've been interrupting job fairs for Heartland Alliance. So we've went to, I think this is like our fifth or sixth job fair that we've went to. The first one that we went to, we pretty much shut them out and they left early, packed up and left early. They didn't have anybody come in. Anybody that they were trying to recruit, we basically talked to them, gave them our flyers about how Heartland Alliance is complicit in the child detention facilities. We wrote a few op-eds about it too. And then as for, we also interrupted their gala event, which was like their local like donors that they would come out. There was a bunch of wealthy people that would show up. There's like, there's a lot of photos of them, like pretty rich white people just donating to this cause. They think it's like a nonprofit. It's all like, it does good and so on and so forth. But we interrupted their gala event. We tried infiltrating, but it didn't quite work out that way due to some security issues. But we were able to interrupt outdoors and basically heckle people who were coming in and out of the event all night long. They weren't able to enjoy it. We've also did several direct actions in front of the facilities themselves, a few noise demos in front of the facilities, basically like kids were waving too. As for the Accenture project, it recently came out in an article this month, I think it was like 2 days ago, posted that Accenture is actually lagging behind on their process. They're supposed to be hiring a few thousand Customs and Border Protection agents, according to like Trump's executive order, but they've only been able to hire two in the last, like I think it's like 13 months. So they were only able to hire two when they were supposed to hire like hundreds already. So we have a firm belief that our efforts are impacting like labor internally. I'm in contact with a few people from like Tech Workers Coalition, who is working with workers inside of Accenture to build solidarity. We wrote a letter in solidarity to the workers as well, who have filed a petition, who are refusing labor. Yeah, that's most of our efforts so far in Chicago. I don't know if Carl has anything else to expand.
I'm not sure right now. I think you covered everything of like based on what we're talking about at the moment, but I'm sure there will be more later.
You know, as we were watching the Abolish ICE movement grow, it was very clear that a lot of the cities, even ones with, you know, maybe medium size or even smaller encampments, for instance, like in Texas, I think it was in San Antonio, you know, they basically stopped the work there and they were like outsourcing it to other places. So, I mean, like the Abolish ICE movement, even in cities where like the encampments were very small, they had like a huge impact on ICE's operations. And, you know, obviously in places like Portland where the encampments were very large, I mean, they had, you know, a very large impact on what was going on. And I'm just curious, you know, looking back on everything that happened over that period and obviously that continues to happen, like, would you say that this is a strategy that definitely, like, you know, could be built upon in a positive sense? Like, this is something that, like, worked. And that, you know, it could obviously go farther, but this is a good starting point for the future.
I mean, I would say so. I mean, like, people are, like, people you wouldn't normally expect to be talking about, like, shit like prison abolition are talking about prison abolition now, I feel like maybe if it didn't necessarily like spring out into like this larger thing, it definitely got people talking about you know, immigration, like heavy immigration reform and, you know, criminal justice reform and like, getting rid of private prison systems and stuff like that.
I also think it's real valid to physically interrupt infrastructure. I saw those people in France bricking up a gateway to an entryway to a government building. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a really good strategy, especially here in Tacoma, because we were right outside of a prison. You know, one of the things that we were able to do was You know, there's a lot of times that people would just be in the street, and in that particular situation, that street is the only way that they can, you know, take immigrants out of the prison or bring them in. And like that frequently got a lot of attention, and we would hear from families that like were leaving or going in that like people knew that we were out there and like appreciated it. And we don't know if like any of the guards like quit, which is one of the things that we were really hoping for. But like now in Tacoma, like there's a lot more attention being paid to what's going on down there. A lot of people in Tacoma don't even like didn't realize that there's a prison. Like this is one of the largest, you know, ICE detention centers in the country. And people weren't aware. And so it's like the other person was saying, like, it's becoming a conversation in circles that I've never heard it mentioned before. And like talking about how what had happened and what we were doing down there, like made them feel like they could also enact some change, even though like not a lot happened for us, like down there, if that makes sense.
For us in Chicago, I think it's made a huge difference, especially when people would find out that they have these child detention facilities in people's neighborhoods. They're all over the city, and they're really nondescript. They just look like a random building on the street, and a lot of them aren't very marked. You can't tell what it is. And when people would find out that that's in their neighborhood, that there are children being held against their will right down the street from them, that seemed to make a huge impact on people.
Well, I want to turn now towards the repression aspect, and I feel like Abolish ICE kind of brought to the fore, you know, not only the police, but also just the role of reactionary fascist and, you know, far right forces. I know in Portland, you know, Patriot Prayer showed up. There was different people that would drive by. In Texas, Patriot Front, which is a, you know, an actual neo-Nazi organization, showed up, kind of like knocked over some stuff for their like viral video, and then kind of left very quickly. But still, I mean, pretty disconcerting. You know, there were other instances as well in different cities. I think Patriot Prayer also attempted to show up in Tacoma once too, and they only got a couple people and maybe left pretty quickly. But I'm just curious if you all can talk about, how did people organize and deal with not only the police repression aspect, you know, which is a whole can of worms in itself, but also the threats from the far right too? Just your thoughts on that.
Well, here in Portland, Patriot Prayer rolls their shit out once every couple of months. So there are groups that have sprung up primarily to respond to them at this point. When they show up to camp, word goes out, and honestly, like, it gives the main camp a whole different group of reinforcements, because there are all kinds of people who are willing to come down and yell at those guys. To be honest, I think that they like pushed against the barricades a few times and made some threatening statements, but those guys, unless there's, you know, an actual fight to be had, don't really do a lot. So there's a lot of yelling back and forth. But they also act as a predecessor and a mark for the cops. We recognize that when they come into the picture, we are more threatened in all situations. It was really we knew that the city had been talking about sweeping for a while. But it was the presence of Patriot Prayer that immediately brought more police attention to the camp, and made pretty swift work of it, quite frankly. And it wasn't just because they were there, but I think that, you know, probably the police thought that there would be more disruption because of it, and whatnot. But it certainly, like, even... even in situations where they don't communicate beforehand with the police, which they also do, they tend to be real close companions. So that's kind of one of the things that we noticed.
In San Francisco, we didn't, all of the far right, besides the police, obviously, all of the far right targeting was pretty much limited to online stuff, harassment, stuff like that. There was a rally down the street that Amber Cummings organized for Tommy What's-His-Dick from the UK, but that had nothing to do with us. And then there was a couple of people that would come by to yell at us or tear shit down, but nothing like actual organized right-wing violence or anything like that.
We got sprayed with liquid manure a couple of times.
Oh, Jesus. That.
Oh, boy.
Fuck.
There's actually a video in France of French farmers doing that to a government building.
So hell yeah, dude.
That sucks.
Here in Chicago, it was mostly police repression. Like, I don't actually recall any engagements with like far right groups whatsoever, probably because they wouldn't want to step foot in Chicago. But like the police, mostly extreme repression from the police, even at the gala event when we were just outside. The way to mitigate that was mostly by filming them. Here in Chicago, we have a public database of police officers called Open Oversight. So we just take photos of cops with their badges and put them up when we have like any problems with the police. So we can always keep track of what officers are particularly violent and shit like that. But yeah, it was mostly cops.
I haven't really had a lot of fascists being involved in Chicago. They usually stay away from the town. We've had a few people taking pictures of us, but I don't necessarily know what that was about. And they pretty rarely step foot in the city, other than like Identity Europa putting up posters. But even that, yeah,
they're from Indiana right too, so like they rarely come by.
So in Tacoma, we didn't actually have to interact very often with a lot of fascists. We voluntarily decamped twice, and like a couple of days after we had decamped for an evening, like the Proud Boys put up this hilarious video of them like strolling down the street with like, there's like six of them, and then are like pouring water and scrubbing off chalk messages and like posing in front of the sign. And like, apparently they thought that was a really big deal. They had like really like, it was really ridiculous music in the background. And then we were supposed to have more people roll through after our camp was swept. And literally like, it was like Anthony Parrish, and like, he was parked at the end of the street and shouting about nothing. And then a bunch of us just like, this is not even a thing. But we had to deal with the cops a lot. You know, like they made a bunch of arrests really early on. And like, they just continuously were coming out and arguing with us about shade structures and, you know, where vehicles were parked. And like, eventually they kind of stopped coming around, but that was because they were prepping to sweep our camp on, you know, July 30th or June 30th, sorry. And like, that was frustrating. I think the most hilarious thing that we ended up having to deal with is that there was this guy who was dropping somebody off at work every day at like 7 o'clock in the morning at shift change. And on his way out, he would park away from where all of us were at and like run down the fence, like tearing down signs, like laughing, and then would speed off if anybody like seemed like they were looking at him. And he did this like every morning for a week. And like, it just didn't make any sense. Like, I don't understand why he thought that that was helpful, or like, we just thought it was hilarious. We wanted to get a picture of him to put up on our wall of shame, because we had a wall of shame for people that would come through and try to argue with us or were just being ridiculous. So, but no one got a good picture.
We had a guy who lived in the neighborhood who would drive by every day on his way home from work blasting Ice Ice Baby. Which we also did not. I was like, is this in favor or against? I don't know if you're supporting or heckling. Do better. Most of our comedy came from DHS, to be honest. Because, you know, they were back in the building pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of coexisting, and they would blast music at us, and they had these spotlights that they put up and, like, aimed directly at the camp at night so that people couldn't sleep.
Yeah, they had that whole cutout thing and put in the...
Oh, my God. Yeah. It was so ridiculous. Yeah, and then, yeah, and they would, like, play Metallica at us and stuff.
I fight commas in the water, preserve the real artists. Modern music is okay, and that's me being modest. We big crown, underground kings of the coast. Now COINTELPRO wanna see us ghost. Cause the drug lab, cook up a dose of the pure mind. I move seven figures, but respected the most. I'm a low representative, reception is negative. It's a crime to be OG and not repetitive. Louise sedative, keep me calm, the right song. With a mind full of fine rhyme, I'm the King Kong. Chaos want me long gone, my rap starts strong arm. They wanna get me like Marley, cause I bring the alarm. It's just like Vietnam. We're out here in the trenches fighting a war that can't be won. I'm a six-eyed soldier, my word is my gun. We come with symphony drums and iron lungs.
It's a top secret war against us. They'll do whatever it takes to end us. They watching operation is stopping the symphony. The industry's got it in for me. So if I should die in old age, ain't the cause. And the CIA was involved. How do you think they solve their problems? By killing those that cause them. I shot them with resistance. I spit it at their system. I hit them with their hate. Remember my identity? It's enemy of the state. For the music I make, controlling fate at our own will. I'm never still, I'm overkill on a stage. Like razor blades on grenades. Blow off your legs if you in the way of interfering. Drug lab producer doubt sample clearing. I'm taking soul and psychedelic. Burn it or sell it. My music still goes down as an underground relic. Grab the jaws of life, we got a force away inside. Blocking the doors, no one here gets out alive.
Music speaks to you every day, but you're too deaf, dumb, and blind to listen.
Now that we're here, we gotta be more careful. They know we move a lot of units at an independent level. You know the devil, if you're not part of the establishment, then they taxing and they taking all your assets. In our case, I'm publishing in masters and royalties. With no compassion, you get dropped, no loyalty. Fuck their seniority. We do our own, take matters to the show and slam. What you suppose? We wouldn't compose music to teach all those. To our advantage, we use it to free our bros. You know, they fly and scheme to take on our team. Because we speak our mind and neglect what they bring. They use diseases and drugs so we could decease, mistreat the restless youth. Why we all at peace? Try to control us with paranoia, but we aware that they have it on sold up, so we define by exposing them.
In a lot of things, whether they're longer term campaigns or things where people have like some sort of encampment where they're outside, you know, there seems to be a point where numbers start to fall. And that's when a lot of times it seems like the police kind of come in. And I'm just curious how people dealt with that, you know, kind of like when you've been doing it for a while and people kind of start to get fatigued a little bit. You know, how do you deal with that kind of feeling?
I could say that in San Francisco, it didn't really, we didn't really get the chance to deal with that sort of thing. As soon as numbers started to dwindle, the SFPD rolled in pretty heavy. I think there was like 120 of them and 40 of us left at the camp when they rolled in. Then they squashed us pretty hard. You know,
for us in Chicago, we've actually kind of had the opposite effect. It's still kind of growing. Little Village Solidarity Network, who I definitely want to give a shout out to, they've been putting on a ton of work, and we've been doing a lot of work with them. And we just had an anti-Amazon action just last week, and that was because Amazon helps ICE track people, and it was actually pretty big, and the police came at us a lot that day, but it was a really solid action. So we've actually continued to still have new faces and just keep plugging along.
Yeah, I think occupation is a tactic, of course, and so once it's no longer useful, your mind drop off most certainly. And I think that we've in Portland, it's been fairly successfully, that energy has kind of been siphoned off into sort of different group attacks on the same issues. So there are groups that are working on support and interfacing with the Honduran Exodus groups. There are, you know, more groups doing defense or legal defense, deportation defense work. So not so much focusing on ICE response as back end stuff, getting people out. We have a great group here, Innovation Law Lab, that has been solidly since the beginning of last summer getting people out of Sheridan, which was one of our prisons here. And there are now no immigrant detainees in that prison. So there's, I mean, there's still work going on, and it just might not be focused in the same place, you know?
The same is true for San Francisco. There's been a lot of stuff that sprung out of this that's not necessarily the central, like, abolish ICE thing. I didn't want to give the impression that, like, we had slowed down completely, because we definitely haven't. There's been a lot of, like, fundraising going on for the caravans that are coming in through Tijuana. People have been going down there to provide support, medical support, stuff like that, and trainings. Just not anything, like, specifically not, like, there haven't been a whole lot of actions, I suppose. But a lot of, like, a lot of fundraising, like barbecues and stuff like that. And, you know, still chugging along, helping with immigration support stuff.
There was a noise demo at the ICE Center in Portland yesterday to support a person who has monthly check-ins. And usually he just has accompaniment, and this time he asked for a noise demo. So things are still going on.
Yeah, here in Tacoma, to answer the original question, you know, we had interesting, like, waves of people coming and then leaving. And so, you know, after the initial arrests, there was, like, a upsurge, and then things started to die down. And what happened in that situation was a lot of the people that were originally supporting our movement here were from Olympia and Seattle. And we had, you know, some Tacoma people, but it wasn't as much, like, Tacoma led. And so we had a couple of femmes step up and kind of, like, take control and start pushing, you know, our ideas again, which then took us about a week and a half of, like I said, about 10 people, like, rotating through. And then we started to regrow. And then once we had an influx of people from Portland come up to support us, like, shortly thereafter, that's when the cops came through and didn't give anybody any time to grab anything, just removed everyone from camp and started taking everything. The only thing that we were able to get out was a wheelchair. And that actually took me an hour of discussion with the cops to even get that. Most of us have not gotten our belongings back. I'm actually in the middle of a fight with the police department about a bunch of things that we need returned. And then, you know, our follow-up, like, we had so many houseless comrades that, like, had come to support who no longer has somewhere to be. So, like, we all took a step back and made sure that our Portland comrades had the money and ability to get back to Portland and took care of the people here. And so, you know, as a group, a Tacoma-based group now, like, we are continuing to support NWCDR, and like, we attend all of the events that we can. Like, they recently had a bunch of different vigils for Mergensana Amar, who was a Russian immigrant who was taken into custody a year ago and went on hunger strike. And then, you know, they claimed that he committed suicide, you know, last month after he was denied an appeal and was told he was going to be deported. And so we make sure that we go to those events. Like, they are currently doing vigils for hunger strikers again. There's, like, 40 immigrants at the detention center that started hunger striking on the 11th because of conditions. So we push their stuff and we attend to it. But we've also tried to build up our capacity. we have an interesting situation in Tacoma where a lot of people that live here don't come out for, you know, anything that isn't like really middle of the line liberal stuff. And so we started a group called Tacoma Mutual Aid Collective, and we're just doing mutual aid and like supporting the things that are already occurring in our area and trying to build up so that, you know, when we have enough people, we can continue to, you know, make some more noise.
Well, we're going to do one more round here. I just wanted to ask, looking back, you know, what are some things that you felt like next time definitely like you would say, like, we do this better? And also, just to piggyback on that, if there's one story that you would share briefly as kind of an inspirational thing that you'll carry with yourself about, you know, abolish ICE, you know, that moment, even though it's still ongoing, obviously, what would it be?
For me personally, my inspiration story is actually the ASL group. Like, that's some real community institution building. I think there's a mutual aid disaster relief group that came through on a tour, and we had a little workshop with them, and they were talking about these opportunities for change that disasters can bring. And I feel like any major breach in like daily sort of order of business gives us that opportunity. And I think that recognizing it and seizing on it more quickly would be what I would want to do better. Just how much growth can happen so quickly in a situation like that for communities. Also, don't let any one group be in charge of anything, especially security.
One of the things that like a lot of our group took away here in Tacoma is like dealing, like, we need to be better dealing with toxic masculinity and like these sort of activism groups. Like, we need to be able to respond way better and way quicker, because, you know, there was a lot of toxicity coming from, you know, mask people at our camp, and there was a lot of issues that stemmed from that because of, you know, excuses that were made or exceptions or like not wanting to make waves. And you know, because a lot of that wasn't addressed quickly, like a lot of the individuals in our camp that you know, come from more marginalized identities, like, were really affected, and it required a lot of care afterwards to make sure that they were back in like a good mental space. And that's just like something that our group specifically is really focusing on now. We have like a lot of individuals that are, you know, doing a lot of reading around like bell hooks and like trying to like figure out how to dismantle, you know, this toxic masculinity that is in them. And we just, like, that's a big lesson that like, we learned and really want to make sure that we take care of quicker. And I'm going to continue to think about like an inspirational story. But I wanted to mention that.
Oh, that's so real here in Chicago too. Just like not realizing that like there's a lack of infrastructure around dealing with that. Like, really, like, in activist spaces, like, there were so many instances where we just had to functioning because there was just these like surges of like toxic masculinity group that just needed to, that we had missing accountability processes for, and like having to develop that along the way really sucked, but learning a lot of lessons through that and just developing them as we go. I totally agree with that.
I don't know if there was any one like inspirational moment, but the
service immediately
when the Accenture workers section inside their own company to drop the contract with CBP, that was a really cool moment, and I was really impressed by that. We did a lot of different stuff, and I think a little bit of everything was pretty inspirational. It was a really great group that we wound up with, and we've continued to do a lot of work with, and I couldn't be more proud of my crew.
Like, you know, other people have said, there's lots of little moments that were really amazing, but like for me, because I was basically living at camp, and living at camp with my 9-year-old, and just like seeing like during the day we were relatively quiet because that was visiting hours, and like our main goal during the day was to provide support and like food and toys to families that were coming in. And so, you know, there wasn't as much rowdiness. And like in those quiet moments, just like being surrounded by people who were invested in like working on themselves while in the midst of this like situation that was definitely like incredibly depressing, not just because of what was going on, but like it is a super fun site, and like it's toxic down there. And so we were all like sick all the time. I had a migraine for like 2 weeks straight. But like watching people continue to like try to work together and try to grow and work through like their own toxicity and their own trauma in this space that like it would have just been so easy to like fall victim to your depression. Like that for me was like amazing to watch, like, you know, the best parts of the human condition, basically.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.